Welcome to another podcast. It's LiesOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Joining us now, John Nichols from the Capital Times and the Nation. Comrade Nichols, welcome to the program.
Pleasure, my friend.
All right, let's let NBC sort of give us a little update on what's going on nationally with that fine president on Pennsylvania Avenue.
Tonight, less than 200 miles from the border in Arizona, the president's pushing immigration as a top midterm issue. He's pointing to a caravan of migrants escaping poverty and violence, making their way through Central America.
They might as well turn back. They're not coming into this country.
That's part of his closing argument as he hits three states in 3 days, with more to come. Senior White House officials telling NBC News the president will make multiple stops daily in the final sprint before the election.
Democrats produce mobs. Republicans produce jobs.
The White House does acknowledge the historical headwinds are against the GOP. After all, with just two exceptions since World War II, midterms are typically bad news for the party controlling the White House. That's why administration officials want to energize the Trump coalition as the president makes the midterms about himself.
Remember this, a vote for David.
A vote for Cindy.
A vote for Steve is a vote for me.
I want you to vote. Pretend I'm on the ballot.
Part of revving up his base means going after the media. And overnight, the president praised an attack on a reporter last year by Montana Congressman Greg Gianforte.
Any guy that can do a body slam, he's my kind.
Now, despite widespread criticism, no regrets.
No.
Hallie Jackson, NBC News, the White House.
All right, so, you know, there are these posers, John, that pretend that they're standing up to Trump. But then when they're really put on the spot, they fade. And as a matter of fact, some of them are cashing in. They write books about civility.
Like, well, Ben Sasse
was on TV. We're taping this Sunday morning. He was just on with Jake Tapper. Listen to this.
To what worked in 2016, seizing on a hardline immigration message and endorsing violence against journalists, seemingly, even as he accuses Democrats of inciting the mob. Joining me now, Senator Ben Sasse, Republican from Nebraska. He's the author of a new book called Them, Why We Hate Each Other and How to Heal. Senator Sasse, thanks for joining us. Your book deals with why the country is so divided right now. I was reading it while this happened, and I want you to take a listen to what President Trump had to say at a recent rally. And he mentioned that Montana congressman who ultimately pleaded guilty to physically assaulting a journalist whose crime was he tried to ask him a question about health care. Take a listen.
Any guy that can do a body slam, he's my kind. And I said, oh, this is terrible. He's going to lose the election. Then I said, well, wait a minute. I know Montana pretty well. I think it might help him. And it did.
And Senator, you write quite compelling in your book about the need for all of us in America to see the humanity of each other. And I have to say, I've been surprised at how quiet Republicans have been about the president of the United States joking about a criminal assault on a reporter. What was your reaction to that?
You know, I got to admit, I don't follow the rallies closely, but, you know, I believe that the First Amendment is the beating heart of the American experiment, so we need to have a president who celebrates the First Amendment and not pretends that beating up a reporter is okay. But I think what you hear from a lot of Nebraskans who also, I think, tune out most of the rallies is there's sort of a short-term, long-term thing going on, and people feel like the president's rhetoric is kind of short-term playful. I don't think it's okay, but I do think most people tune most of it out. I think what we need to be having a conversation about is the long term of how does the next generation understand the American experiment? Because right now, we don't have much shared sense of what it is.
Could you think of a worse answer?
No, not really not. You know, I mean, a term like the president was wrong might have been good. But the other thing is, what is this term, short-term playful?
What the hell does that mean?
I just want to, well, you know, Sly, next time you're in court, I'm going to come in. If you want me to testify, I'm going to testify on your behalf and say he was just being short-term playful.
Short-term playful.
Short-term playful.
You know,
it's all, you know, just passing fancy. You know what it sounds like? You know what it sounds like is boys will be boys.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And with all due respect to Senator Sasse, who sat on the Judiciary Committee and cast a horrible vote on the Kavanaugh nomination, and who, you know, on the tax bill and on the budget, on issue after issue after issue, has been a lockstep supporter of this president and who only criticizes this president, along with Jeff Flake and Bob Corker.
Free trade.
You know, but even there, what if there was an actual vote? Do you think he'd do the right thing? I don't know. You know, it's like this is the problematic thing.
Well, define the right vote on that one.
on which one?
On trade.
Yeah, I know. But, well,
I certainly don't agree with Ben Sasse on trade.
Is he going to bring, but would he bring any, would he stand up to Trump on things? Or would he do, and the weirdest part is, these guys are lockstep, tend to be lockstep Trump backers. And so they give this gentle criticism. It's kind of like, remember the classic from Paul Ryan, where Trump said something horrible. It was just awful. It was in the spring. And Ryan said, well, we don't say it that way. And, you know, I mean, I think that just sums it up. These people are, quote unquote, concerned about civility, right? Which is a code word for saying, well, we're concerned about how you talk about this stuff. I am concerned about how Trump talks about things, but I'm also concerned about what Trump does. And, you know, I think that the people like Ben Sasse, sadly, and this also goes for John Kasich and for, you know, so many of these other folks, is that they grab TV time to spell out a critique of Trump that is 100% meaningless, that does nothing to influence the national debate or tip the
balance. Well, I'm going to disagree with you a little bit there. I actually think it's not meaningless. I actually think it's dangerous because it's actually harmful because it lets the president get away with awful behavior and his followers. You know, the whole premise of Ben Sasse's book is about how we've lost a sense of community and small towns dying and people not going to local stores. The whole economic premise of that guy's book is antithetical to his voting record.
Right. I mean, well, look, he's a very over-intellectualized, under-experienced human being. And, you know, the interesting thing is that you see a lot of this in the Republican Party now. And the fact is, it used to be you had great diversity within the Republican Party. You had liberals, moderates, and conservatives within the party. You also had sort of like really independent and maverick Republicans, a lot of them. And so it worked for them. Now, the interesting dynamic is that you have these people who, frankly, you know, I guess you could call them cable TV moderates or whatever. And, you know, the biggest one of the bunch is Lindsey Graham. Right? I mean, he's always there, and he's always like saying bold, dissident things that are, you know, a little bit off-key, right? Until he's needed. And then, wham, he's right back in there, you know, like closing the circle for Trump. And so I'm intrigued that the Des Moines Register out in Iowa a couple days ago, did a very interesting thing. They made their endorsements for congressional races in Iowa. Historically, the Des Moines Register has done Democratic and Republican endorsements. They do try to mix it up, and they really seek more moderate Republicans.
They're a Gannett paper.
They are, but they also, in fairness to them, maintain a real kind of connectedness to the state. I'm generally a fan of what they do, and I like what they do more than a lot of papers, major papers around the country. Anyway, they made endorsements, and they endorsed all Democrats for congressional seats. And they said right up front, you know, essentially, we don't really like doing this. We usually like to mix it up and stuff like that. But they said, you know, this year, you got to figure out the reality that if you elect Republicans, they are going to sustain Donald Trump. And there needs to be a check and balance on this presidency.
Well,
so it's interesting to see that they went to that place.
The Houston Chronicle, which has a long history of endorsing Republicans, endorsed Beto O'Rourke for U.S. Senate.
This is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And I'm seeing it around the country more and more. Now, as we know, newspaper endorsements didn't exactly stop Trump in 2016. So I understand the dynamic here. But I think in a midterm election, it's a very interesting phenomenon. My sense of what is happening is you're seeing an appeal from these mainstream traditional daily newspapers to a very, frankly, a very targeted group of people, which is sort of, you know, those who were traditionally moderate, relatively moderate Republicans, generally suburbanites, sometimes urban folks, even in some cases rural folks, but folks who, you know, kind of had a certain vision of the party. And what they're saying is an interesting thing, if they say it at their best, and that is, you may still be a Republican. You may still be fiscally conservative, you know, very strong for defense spending, things like that. But you have to recognize that it is unhealthy to have Donald Trump with unitary power, like to have him in charge of a government where the entire legislative branch is essentially his echo chamber, and frankly where the Supreme Court is, you know, headed in the same direction.
So here is a little clip from NBC about the Democrats and health care.
President Trump has signaled his midterm strategy. Democrats are pinning their hopes for a blue wave on mainly one issue, health care, like vulnerable red state Democrat Claire McCaskill in this new ad, invoking her own battle with breast cancer.
But those who face cancer and many other illnesses have a pre-existing condition when it comes to health coverage.
Tonight, polls suggesting that health care is the most important issue in the midterms, while some Republicans once railed against all aspects of Obamacare.
I intend to speak in support of defunding Obamacare until I am no longer able to stand.
Many are now talking about keeping key portions, like coverage for pre-existing conditions.
I want to repeal Obamacare, reduce premiums, protect pre-existing conditions, and expand access.
Even this personal appeal from Republican Governor Scott Walker in a tight re-election race in Wisconsin.
My wife, Tina, is a type 1 diabetic. My mother is a survivor of breast cancer. And my brother has a heart condition. See, covering pre-existing conditions is personal to me.
President Trump tweeting overnight, all Republicans support people with pre-existing conditions, and if they don't, they will after I speak to them. Democrats think it's one more big issue that will help them win over a critical voting bloc, suburban women. Lester.
Goodbye.
Kristen Welker.
So, Ted Cruz and Scott Walker are modern-day Tommy Douglases.
Yeah, well, really, I think, you know, it's not ruled out that when Bernie Sanders comes to Wisconsin this week, you know, Scott Walker is maybe appearing with to endorse Medicare for All. But on the chance that it doesn't happen, were you surprised that Scott didn't mention his pre-existing condition, the head injury there?
Oh, with the bald spot, yeah.
Yeah, you know, on the cabinet. That I was, you know, interested in bringing that up, but...
It kind of looks like it's getting a little worse, too.
No, I think it looked great. But here's the interesting thing. I actually think that report was wrong. I think that report was wrong, and I think that if Democrats just kind of stay wedged into pre-existing condition, they're making something of a mistake. They should keep going on it. There's no question. But they've essentially won the issue, right? When you've got Ted Cruz and Scott Walker and people like that rushing over to say, yeah, I'm more concerned than, you know, than the Democrats are about that. And in fact, you know, I'm so concerned I'm going to not do anything about the lawsuit to overturn it. But I would move on. Where I would move to is where Mitch McConnell took us this last couple days, which is, you know, he said that he can't quite figure out how, but somehow we're despite the fact that he did all his tax cuts that he promised we're going to, you know, boost revenues, and despite the fact they did a budget they promised was somehow going to boost revenue, you know, all these things are going to be good. We're heading toward a $1 trillion deficit. And he said, well, okay, he's figured it out. It's Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. And to be honest, if I was the Democrats in these closing 3 weeks, I would, you know, keep the pre-existing condition thing there, but I would go wild on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. I would talk about that every day.
I think the media might be a little bit behind the curve on that. I do think there are some candidates already pouncing on that. We'll talk more with John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation at SlysOffice.com next. Welcome back to SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers and great local sponsors like Madison Computer Works, Madison Firefighters Local 311, Madison Teachers Incorporated, and our friend friends with Madison Teamsters, Local 695. All right, so Friday night, the Milwaukee Brewers were playing the Los Angeles Dodgers, Game 6 of the NL Championship Series. Then we had the Bucks playing their first game at the Fiserv Forum. And then we had a senatorial debate and a gubernatorial debate. I kind of think the Major League Baseball won out in the ratings on that one, John.
You think? You know, when they were literally like asking during the debate, what's the Brewers score? I'll just suggest, though, that on that night, the best debate and the best event was the Randy Bryce, Brian Stile debate down in Oak Creek. That was wild.
What happened?
Yeah. Before the debate, the room, it was like a really well-done debate because it's old school, you know, like local. Wisconsin High did it in a nice way. They had, you know, a big room, a lot of people sitting on folding chairs. But like half the room was Brian Stile people. They were all looking very serious, a lot of med suits on. And the other half was Randy Bryce people. A lot of them had hard hats on and stuff. And like a few minutes before the debate started, everybody's sitting around, you know, how it gets real quiet in the room. And some guy stands up and starts singing Solidarity Forever. And the whole Randy Bryce side's on its feet, you know, clapping hands and stomping and have fists in the air, and they're singing Solidarity Forever. And then the debate starts.
Brian Stile didn't join in on that?
No, he didn't.
You know, he's a manufacturer. I don't know if you know that.
Yeah. You know, well, there was a, you know, and then, of course, he had his, like, manufactured cheap shots. Like, Randy Bryce was going after him about being a corporate lawyer. And then Stile goes, well, you could have used a lawyer in some of those arrests. And, you know, so it got kind of raucous and nasty, and people were cheering. And frankly, you know, it was just fun. It was a fun debate.
Well, the gubernatorial debate was not fun.
It wasn't wrong.
It was boring. But let me play some clips from this. Scott Walker was asked about the fact that a fourth cabinet member, this time the former Green Bay Mayor Paul Jaden, who was his first WEDIC director, mm-hmm. came out and basically said Scott Walker was finding any way he could to push blame on other people for his lack of creating 250,000 jobs, which, of course, he still hasn't reached. Here is Scott Walker's response.
Thank you both for being here tonight. We start tonight with credibility. Governor Walker, as of this week, four of your former cabinet secretaries have publicly criticized you. Your former transportation secretary says you're inaccurate about state highways. Secretaries of financial institutions, corrections, and economic development say they initially believed in your vision for the state, but described your leadership with terms like schemes and cover-up and, quote, micromanagement, manipulation, and mischief, including directives not to leave a paper trail on major decisions. How does the fact that four of your appointees are raising these allegations affect your credibility?
Well, thanks for the question. And first off, I want to say it's a good evening, and it's a little bit hard for me to imagine being here tonight without my father in the audience. So I want to begin by thanking so many of you who offered your condolences, including you, Tony. Thank you very much for that. 8 years ago, Tonette and I were worried that our kids weren't going to be able to find a job, let alone a career, because the unemployment rate was 9.3%. And since then, we've seen a tremendous turnaround. More people are working in the state than ever before, which is why we're working on workforce. And over the next 4 years, I'd like to continue to grow that and keep our graduates here. But Jessica, to your specific question, it's simple. I'm not afraid to have people with diverse opinions in my cabinet. For years, I had a cabinet member who wanted to raise the gas tax, and I told the voters clearly I would never raise the gas tax without an equal or greater reduction elsewhere in their tax burden overall. Even in addition to my cabinet, when I was in county government, I had a member of the cabinet there who worked for a Democrat United States Congress, and I even had a personal aide in the past who worked for Joe Lieberman, who was a running mate with Al Gore when he ran for president in 2000. I'm not afraid to have people with diverse opinions out there, but what I always will do is be straight with the voters of the state of Wisconsin. I'll tell you what I'm going to do, and then I'll follow up and do it. And I hope you can see, based upon our record, we've got more people working in this state than ever before, some of the best schools in the nation, and your property taxes are lower today than before you started.
You know, I don't know why people that ask questions during a debate just don't interrupt these people and say, you're not answering my question.
Well, sometimes you'll guys that would do that, but you know, sort of that inner moderator role in that debate. But the other one, I don't think he should really interrupt. I think when he's done, you should just have let the questioner be able to have a review of the answer and say, that hurt my head, because that was a painful answer.
Careful now. Don't. Scott Walker is a victim of a head injury.
Yeah, back of it there.
Right.
But that was a painful, painful answer. Only because two things. Number one, Scott is very good at what he does. I mean, that was a very, very carefully crafted answer, right, to get a lot of political messaging out, and then to sort of deep six the critique within it and make him sound like a good guy. But, you know, I like that idea that he wanted a diversity of opinion.
Yeah.
And, like, one of the diverse opinions held by the people who signed this letter criticizing him was that at critical points in his governorship, he, you know, basically signed over the duty of being governor to someone else so he could go off and run for president.
Governor Eric Schutt.
Well, that's what I'm saying is the guy is, you know, I mean, this is not diverse opinion. These are people saying, you're a bad governor. It's like, you know, we came and we observed you, and you did a rotten job of this, and you weren't very honest, and you didn't do your job when you were supposed to, and you tried to be secretive on critical things, and importantly, especially if you look at some of the comments from these folks, that every decision you made was you know, basically guided back to your own political advantage.
Do you remember 4 years ago when the Republicans unearthed a memo that Corey Nettles, who was in the Doyle administration, wrote that was critical of Mary Burke's tenure as Commerce Secretary, basically
right,
saying she was absent? Man, they had their talk radio machine on top of that, and I think it was a pretty big blow to her in the final days
harmful.
Of that campaign. It was very harmful.
It was one of several things. You know, they actually, intriguingly enough, the Walker operation, they're very good at what they do, and I think the governor himself is at the heart of it. I think he's very, very good at a lot of messaging, and give him credit for that. But my sense is that the reason they're having trouble in this campaign is that they have kind of a greatest hits, and they're sort of like, you know, it's kind of like REO Speedwagon trying to recreate Roll with the Changes, if that metaphor works for you.
I think you're missing one there. Do you realize that REO Speedwagon was just voted by the people of Illinois as the all-time greatest group of musicians in Illinois history?
I totally agree. I want them in my Illinois rock tour. And beyond that, they also played, I think during the Brewers game, in one of the breaks, you were hearing some REO stuff. It's not a criticism of REO. It's just that they haven't really succeeded in kind of recreating hits. You know, like they don't have a lot of current hits.
No.
You know what I'm saying?
They're not the Foo Fighters.
And so what Scott Walker tries to do is sort of like recreate the greatest hits in each campaign. And do you remember one of the things that they came out against, that they really went after Mary Burke on, I believe, didn't they go after her on plagiarism?
Well, this is interesting. So now that's an issue in this campaign as well, because the Walker campaign thinks they've come up with a issue against Tony Evers. Let me play that.
Keeping the focus on credibility, Mr. Evers, Politico reported today and your Department of Public Instruction confirmed that four passages in your recently submitted department budget were plagiarized. The sections include 15 paragraphs that have been lifted from a blog post and other paragraphs that were taken from a Wikipedia entry without attribution. You've been a lifelong educator, and your own Department of Public Instruction website warns about the dangers of plagiarism. Just as we asked Governor Walker, what does it say about your credibility that this would happen under your watch?
Well, if this is the best Scott Walker has, he doesn't have much, I'll tell you that. We dropped a few citations from the back pages of a budget. We talked to the people involved. It was a mistake, and they fixed it. Now, the last thing I need in my life is to have Scott Walker lecturing me about the issue of of plagiarism, frankly. He takes budget items directly from national organizations and high dollar sponsors, passes them into law without barely changing a word. The issue about my budget is this. It is going to ask for a $1.4 billion extra for the kids of Wisconsin. That's what's important to me, not citations. That $1.4 billion is what we're going to be used to take care of the $800 million that Scott Walker took out of the budget just a handful of years ago.
I thought he was ready for that question.
I actually thought he handled it very well. You know, the one thing about the difference between Scott Walker and Tony Evers.
Well, there's a lot of differences.
There are many differences, but in this debate setting, Walker is a pro, right? So his answer was very smooth, right? And you know, it flows, you know, in kind of perfect meter. Whereas Evers does pause, and, you know, he's got sort of that, if you recall when Jimmy Carter was starting in politics, where Carter would, you know, sometimes, you know, not be quite as fluid as other politicians when he said stuff. And yet, if you listened, if anybody who was actually listening to the debate and heard what Evers said there, that was a really good answer. And, you know, because he did a couple of things. First off, he dealt with the issue right up front, by
he
the
did.
Way, unlike
yeah.
Walker, you know, who, you know, had all sorts of spin around it, because it's a much more serious issue for Walker. Then he addresses the issue right up front in a very thorough way. But then he goes at Walker and he says, you know, look, we're going to talk about this. Scott Walker has essentially not just taken a paragraph here or there. He literally has taken a full agenda from national groups like ALEC.
Well, you remember that Act 10 was boilerplate. That was written. Mm-hmm. that wasn't created by Scott Walker.
Same with right to work. Same with, you know, so many of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, this is the thing about Scott. Scott loves politics. Scott Walker loves politics. He loves, you know.
More so than being governor.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
He loves getting elected. He loves the campaign. I actually truly believe that even in this tight campaign, a rough one for him, probably the toughest he's run in a long time, he is enjoying it because he loves the strategy, the polls, the structure of it all. But governing, by all evidence, and I think we see it from his former cabinet members, bores the hell out of him.
Well,
and so
this goes
what
back
do you
to,
do when you're not interested?
This goes back to what his professor said at Marquette. I hate to analyze him, but mm-hmm. that he loved the campaign. He loved running for class president, and he loved the politics and learning about politics. But as far as issues, he was not interested in policy at all.
And he phones it in
all.
Once yeah, he has
right.
power.
So where are we at in this campaign? What are you hearing? And you can sort of read people's bullshit. When it comes to, and we can say that because this is a podcast, and whether people are
mallet, though, don't
spinning
we?
You, yeah, right. What's your sense of where this race is? Is for governor? We know where the Senate yeah. race is. I think that's
yeah,
pretty,
boy, I can tell you the Senate race is yeah.
At least right now.
No, it's pretty. There's a lot of clarity on that one.
Right.
I think, but I think they're not unrelated. The fact of the matter is that it looks like it's going to be a at least reasonably good Democratic year in Wisconsin. I mean, if the Senate race is an indicator and some of these other patterns. And that is very relevant as regards the governor's race, because if you're getting, you know, a lot of people out to vote Democratic for the Senate, and back Tammy Baldwin and back other Democrats, some of that benefits Evers right off the bat. By the same token, Walker has from the start of this thing tried very, very hard to position himself as somebody who could get at least some Democratic votes. He's trying for a Baldwin-Walker vote, if you can imagine it. And I suspect that he's close. I mean, I don't think there's any question the governor's race is closer. My sense is that right now, if we put all these pieces together, I would suggest that Evers is probably ahead by a point or so. You know, that he's got a little bit of an advantage right now, and it may actually be improving at this point.
Well, as I watched
the first debate, I don't think this debate that we just reflected on, because of some of the factors you talked about,
right.
I certainly don't think it did Evers any harm.
You know, as the as we record this, I'm looking at the maple trees in my backyard, and the wind has switched directions a couple times. For a while, the wind was blowing from the east, and then it was blowing from the west. In states like Wisconsin and Florida that are so evenly divided, in Arizona, in Nevada, it kind of seems like it's going to depend on Election Day which way the wind is blowing. And yet, early voting has started in all these in these states as well. So it's really hard to figure out.
Your most poetic.
Thank you.
Soliloquy ever. Sly the wind and the trees. Very lovely. Henry David Sly. But I'm with you there. I think your analysis is right. But what I will suggest to you is that we are now in the period, you know, we're coming into the 2-week period here where it starts to lock in. And the dynamics are interesting. Trump coming in for the Republicans, Obama coming in for the Democrats.
Bernie Sanders
coming in, and especially going into Kenosha there, which I think is very, very important on Sanders' part. My sense is that when you put all these factors, you're right about your wind and all that and the leaves, but I will suggest there's something else. There is pattern. You're noticing the wind and the leaves and all that because it's fall. We have seasons. Some things happen by pattern.
Yeah, Saturday was really something, wasn't it?
It sure was. I saw snow. But the pattern, the one pattern that is pretty well baked into Wisconsin, I mean, unless we're in a new age, and it's possible there's climate change, but if pretty well baked in, is that when you have a president, of a new president of one party in D.C., 2 years after that president gets elected, Wisconsin elects a governor of the other party. Doesn't always happen, but just to give you an example, Obama comes in 2 years later, Scott Walker, and a lot of Republicans are elected. Bush comes in 2 years later, you know, Jim Doyle, and a lot of Democrats are elected.
Ronald Reagan.
The pattern is
Tony Earle.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So if we accept that there is sort of a pattern there and that it makes a kind of...
Wait a minute, one more.
Oh.
Jimmy Carter gets elected. Lee Dreyfus gets elected.
There you go. No, you can, and you could go back to like the 50s even. This is from the age of the modern Democratic Party. Doesn't always happen. There can be some other factors, but generally this is the pattern.
Gaylord Nelson.
Exactly. So if we operate on this mode... Well, I mean, by the way, the biggest one of all, Nixon 68... carries Wisconsin, wins nationally.
Pat Lucey.
70, complete sweeping victory for the Democrats. And so this kind of going back and forth thing, I think this is a very good year for it, to be honest. My sense is that unless money and politics and some of these other things have really shifted the game, that there is on balance, an advantage that the Democrats have. And that advantage is that there's a Republican sitting in the White House. And it isn't just that it's Trump. It is, you know, any Republican sitting in the White House at this point. So my sense is that if the Democrats kind of keep the churn going, keep working it in the right way, and they are working very hard. I was, Saturday night, I was at went to the Sylvie, the new concert hall in Madison, and Bon Iver was there with Tammy Baldwin, a very dynamic show packed with millennials and younger folks. You know what I mean? Very effective. Sunday, you had Kamala Harris coming for Baldwin. Monday, it's Bernie Sanders for Baldwin, Evers, Randy Bryce. You know, then following Friday, I believe, it's coming up. It's Obama and stuff. You know what I mean? And certainly Trump is coming in for the Republicans. But my sense is the Democrats kind of have their game on. And so I'm not going to say anything is settled because I think it's always dumb to do that early on. But I would say that the patterns of the Democrats look better this time, certainly than they did in 2014 or 2010.
John Nichols from the Capital Times and The Nation. Thanks for coming to SlysOffice.com.